ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
This August, Science Week is blooming around the ABC.
This Science Week, we're celebrating Australia's wildflowers.
Get involved. Vote now in the search for Australia's favourite wildflower
at abc.net.au/science. Celebrate Science Week with us in August on ABC Radio National
and at abc.net.au/science.
The headlines might have moved on,
but in the occupied West Bank, the violence hasn't.
Israeli settler violence has reached unprecedented levels in recent weeks.
And with an election looming, more may be on the horizon.
I'm Kylie Morris.
And I'm Latika Burke. Today on Global Roaming, a first-hand account inside the occupied West Bank. Kylie, this is a subject close to your heart as a former reporter inside Gaza.
It is, indeed. And I'm interested in Anthony Lowenstein, our guest in today's episode, because I think he has some pretty unique insights into what is going on inside Gaza, but particularly inside the West Bank, because that's where he's been. I think it's an important conversation, particularly given you might have heard the conversation that Hamish and Geraldine had on Israel and Jewish identity with Peter Beinart. That was a fascinating kind of intellectual conversation about how we think about ourselves and what it means to be Jewish in a post-Gaza world. But today we're taking a different view. I suppose Anthony is bringing us a look at the issue from the ground level.
Yes, and this has been a topic, I think, safe to say, well overlooked. One, as Gaza took centre stage, then we had the ceasefire, and then, of course, the beginning of the Iran war, Kylie, and we've heard very, very little about what is taking place in the West Bank. And what is taking place in the West Bank is an intensification of violence there. This has led to sanctions from Western governments, including, of course, Australia, about this persecution of the Palestinians. What is the goal of the settlers? What is the goal of the Israeli government? How much of this violent conduct is authorised by the Israeli government? These are the questions that we have for our guest today.
That's right. I follow a number of these communities and I'm looped into social media posts from some of the Palestinian villagers who are trying to track and record the attacks that they're undergoing or that they're experiencing at the hands of the settlers. And it is chilling on a daily basis. You know, you see people, men normally running into villages in the middle of the night, trying to set things on fire, livestock being killed, people being threatened, physically abused. There was a video taken of a settler shooting a Palestinian villager and killing him about a year ago. That anniversary of that death has just been marked in Hebron. So there is a visceral reality, a terrifying reality for lots of Palestinians in the West Bank. And it's something that we, as you say, we don't understand, we're not focused on, but I'm hopeful that will change with the conversation today. So our guest today is Anthony Lowenstein. He's an independent Australian journalist, filmmaker, and author of the Walkley Award-winning book, The Palestine Laboratory, which I would recommend for its analysis of the way in which defence industries, and particularly the Israeli defence industries, are profiting from their war with Hamas. He was based in East Jerusalem between 2016 and 2020. He has his own podcast called the Anthony Lowenstein Podcast and is currently writing another book on Israel and Palestine due to be released later next year. Anthony Lowenstein, welcome to Global Roaming.
Thanks for having me.
So you were in the West Bank recently, last month. What did you see?
I've been going to the West Bank for over 20 years. And the situation there is always grim. I think when people think about the situation there, they now and then hear stories about settler violence, settler extremism, dispossession of Palestinians, and all that's obviously true. But one thing I saw this time, and I haven't been there for about a year and a half, is the acceleration of all those things. And what I mean by that is as soon as you cross from Israel into the West Bank, and people might not understand the geography, but when you're in, say, Tel Aviv, you can go into the West Bank within about an hour. And as soon as you cross, you see massive Israeli flags. And the people I was with were telling me that had been put in there since October 7. Literally across every single road, meter after meter after meter. I was going near Hebron, one of the major cities, and I was visiting a Palestinian village, a handful of people who lived in very remote areas, almost biblical in terms of its simplicity. They lived in caves. They'd been there for generations. These were a poor Palestinian family who had sheep, and they were being constantly attacked by settlers. They had been attacked daily. They were being attacked themselves. Their animals were being attacked. Their sheep were being killed.
When you say attacks, what is the nature of the attack?
The attack is usually physical. So they, settlers, and I saw footage of this, they were regularly coming to mete out violence, essentially. They were either trying to physically attack the individuals, they were regularly attacking or taking their sheep, they were trying to destroy their structures where they lived. And I've made this mistake myself, and I still do it over the years, and we talk about settlers. Settlers almost seems like the wrong word. These are basically religious fanatics, and these people have always been in the West Bank. I mean, they've been there really since after the 1967 war when Israel took control of these territories. But there's kind of been a radicalization of the radicals. In other words, there's about 800,000 settlers in the West Bank. They're not all violent. I mean, they're all there illegally under international law, but they're not all violent, but a sizable minority are. And the violence that is increased, particularly since October 7, particularly since the current makeup of the Israeli government, which is very pro-settler, which sees the aim of the settlement movement to push and kick Palestinians out. So just briefly, this family that I spent time with, they were still there on their land, but there was a degree of inevitability that they would not be able to survive there. And what I mean by that is I've been to case after case after case of Palestinians who we all have a breaking point. If you are being attacked and chased and harassed and the Israeli military and the police are on the side of the settlers, your existence there is temporary, even though you've been there for generations. And this family was very much like that. So the sense I had there was things had gone from being incredibly bad to almost apocalyptic. And that is reflected in the fact that huge amounts of Palestinians have been kicked off their lands in the last years, and this has been going on for decades, but it's accelerated in the last years. And the ultimate goal, I believe, and this is really expressed by Israeli government ministers, is to have as few Palestinians in Palestine as possible. That is the ultimate goal, to remove them permanently. I'm not saying to kill them all, I'm saying to remove them to somewhere, Jordan, Egypt. And although that's been a dream of many of the Israeli right for decades, in the last years that has become far more overt. And Israeli ministers say this, it's not me making it up, they're literally saying this.
Anthony, I'm interested in what you see as the kind of trigger point for this recent intensification. I mean, I think you're right. I mean, human rights groups like B'Tselem have documented over many years the increasing number of attacks against Palestinians, both around Hebron, but generally across the West Bank.
Yeah.
But what do you see as the trigger now for, in the past few months, this very hardline, aggressive stance from settlers and with the IDF support in many cases? What's driving it?
I think there's a few things. One, October 7, which obviously happened nearly 3 years ago, but certainly since then there's been a huge acceleration. I think a lot of the world's attention was on Gaza, not surprisingly, and many of the Israeli government ministers and settlers saw an opportunity to accelerate their program in the West Bank, A. B, there's an Israeli election at the end of October, October 27. Netanyahu, the prime minister, is up for re-election. God knows if he's going to win. He's a cat with nine lives. I think there's also a radicalization, not just in the last months and the last years, of the Israeli army that I think a lot of people don't realize that there's a sizable proportion of the military. The soldiers are settlers, not every single one, but a sizable proportion of the Israeli military are now settlers themselves. So that's been a concerted campaign for years to bring in far more like-minded soldiers, settlers, who think like this, who believe that Palestinians should be kicked off their land. And the violence, I think, is so extreme because there's no accountability. There's not like there's anyone being held to account. There are Palestinians being murdered and dispossessed. It's not like people are being put on trial for that or charged. So there's a complete culture of impunity. And I think also, and I've written about this a lot over the years, in the Israeli Jewish public, yes, there are some people, of course, who oppose what's going on. That's a given. But there is a decent percentage of people, in fact, I would argue a majority, who do not think that Israel should leave the West Bank. Doesn't mean they all support extreme violence. No. But there is a belief that as Israelis, we need to hold on to this land for our own security or our own safety, whatever the argument is. And therefore, whatever needs to be done out of sight, out of mind, is okay. And the reality, I think, is that the image of Israel, the reputation of Israel, has profoundly collapsed. But I think it's an acceleration of violence because they can get away with it.
So, Anthony, you say right now they're acting with impunity, but will there be impunity come the election? What do we know about how the Israeli people view this violence and whether they think that this does deserve punishment?
If you speak to a number of Israeli Jewish citizens, journalists, activists, of course there are people who will say, we don't think Palestinians should be murdered. But the truth is that there is impunity. And I say that based on the records of the Israeli military itself, who say and release these figures that the impunity rate is close to 100%. Settlers do not get charged. They do not get prosecuted. They do not get put on trial. So the most radical elements of the settler movement, and again, it's worth saying there is no real separation here between the settler movement and the government. The idea that is sometimes expressed, well, there's this radical fringe. Netanyahu has asked himself about this issue, and you've seen these, I'm sure, in the media, where he says, oh, there's just 150 crazy youth and we can't control them. What does that even mean? I mean, firstly, it's nonsense. There's far, far more than that. And secondly, what do you mean you can't control them? You literally control the entire territory. The aim of the settlers is to almost be the figurehead of the government. So when you ask how do most Israeli Jews feel about this, well, election after election after election, and I suspect including the forthcoming election, they're voting for parties that do not want this to end. I mean, that's who they're voting for. The likely success of Netanyahu, if he loses, at the moment, as I said, it's too hard to say, their views on the West Bank, on Gaza, is no different. The rhetoric might be different, but the practical reality is the same thing. And that represents the Israeli mainstream view, is Jewish mainstream view, which is the occupation needs to continue. Yes, if you ask some of them, they'll say, well, of course, we don't want Palestinians to be murdered and killed because they realize it's bad PR. But on the ground, the practical reality is they believe Israel should maintain this land forever. That's the philosophy. I mean, they say it themselves. It's not me making it up. They literally say that. So change here will not come from within. Israeli Jewish populations will not suddenly wake up one day and think the occupation is illegal and terrible and bad and it should end. It will come from outside pressure. It's the only way.
You're listening to Global Roaming with Kylie Morris and me, Latika Berg. We're talking to independent journalist and filmmaker Anthony Lowenstein on his recent trip to the West Bank.
Anthony, last month, Penny Wong's office announced a number of new sanctions against settlers and their settlements, in particular targeting Yinon Levy, who is the settler who shot and killed Auda Hafalin in Umm al-Khair or Masafa Yatta, which I'd imagine is one of the places that you visited.
I did visit there, yes.
Yeah. He himself is already subject to sanctions by the Australian government on human rights grounds, this settler. But they've added now targeted financial sanctions against the farm and outpost that he founded. It means that anyone who transfers funds, makes assets available to, or engages in commercial transactions with those farms and outposts is committing a serious criminal offence in Australia. Is that the kind of outside pressure that you're talking about?
I mean, I welcome the Australian government's sanctions of these kinds of people, but this really is tinkling at the edges here. I mean, there are a lot of countries, including Europe and including the US before Trump, under Biden, Trump removed these sanctions, which did sanction people like this, the extreme settlers who are causing carnage. But it doesn't really address any of the key issues. And Penny Wong would know this. It's not like she doesn't know. She knows. This is not about a few individuals doing terrible things. Of course, it is that as well. But this is a government system. You need to sanction ministers. You need to sanction a government. You need to not continue sending weapons parts to Israel, which Australia continues to do. We all know, and there's a poll that came out recently by Pew in the US, which polled about 35 countries around the world about their attitudes towards Israel. And virtually every country had negative views. Australia had the highest between 18 to 35 year olds of the most negative views towards Israel. And that is because of these kinds of things. So do I welcome sanctioning extremists? Yes. But will it make a difference? No, it won't. Because, and it's worth saying, there are a number of far-right Jewish groups in Australia who are fundraising for settlers and also host events in Sydney and Melbourne. These are publicly available events, selling properties in the West Bank. Does Australia sanction those Australian groups? Do they try to remove the events? No. This is what is going on day after day after day now. They're not doing anything about it. I think ultimately the Australian government has a very selective outrage about if it's, say, Russia committing abuses in Ukraine, which undeniably they've been doing for years. They see it very, very differently to say Israel's committing crimes or genocide or ethnic cleansing in the West Bank and Gaza. There is a certain worldview which is very different to, say, Russia versus Israel, the US ally versus a US enemy. I think Penny Wong, and not just Penny Wong, but Albanese and others see it that way. And I think people see that hypocrisy.
I guess really the only outside pressure that matters to Israel, though, is the United States. And we saw Jedi Vance saying, Donald Trump is the last friend you have, guys. Wake up to yourselves. Do you not see a future where post the Israeli elections, the post-Trump world in the United States, things might be very different for Israel?
I think Israel's worried about that. They say it privately. They say it publicly within Israel. They are concerned that the American public itself are turning against Israel, not just the left, the far left, the right. I mean, it's worth saying that the caveat to all that is that it hasn't changed anything about US policy yet. Israel still has impunity to act as it wants in Lebanon and Iran and the West Bank and Gaza. It has not changed that yet. But there's no doubt that the US shifting its potential position has the potential to change a lot. As many Israeli friends of mine will say, if the US wants to end the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza, they could end it within days or weeks if they chose to cut weapons funding, cut support, cut military aid, cut diplomatic support for Israel. It's a choice. I don't think someone like Trump will do that. I don't even think necessarily J.D. Vance, if he becomes president, would. But if someone like a more progressive Democrat, and obviously the Democratic Party in the US is becoming certainly not so much at the leadership level, but more grassroots, far more critical, it could change, absolutely. But again, words are not enough. Rhetoric and reality is the difference here. So Israel is spending insane amounts of money on propaganda within the US. I'm talking about trying to impact social media companies, putting pressure on social media companies, trying to impact AI searches. I'm not convinced any of that's going to work at all to change public opinion, but they realize that long term, Israel has a problem. So yes, it could change, but I'm yet to see evidence so far practically on a policy level that it will or that it can.
Anthony, I don't want our conversation to finish without addressing Gaza and the widening gap, if you like. Maybe that's too generous a way to view it, but between Trump and Netanyahu on Gaza has been very plain to see in the last week or so, where President Trump announced that Hamas now has agreed to disarm, that there's going to be a pilot city built in Rafah, that there are going to be international observers involved in the, you know, making that area secure. And Netanyahu has basically rejected it out of hand. I mean, he hasn't done that himself personally, but that's what we're hearing from the ministers. He presumably doesn't want to go into an election taking any backward steps. So now that we're at the pointy end of that, and certainly no one more so than for the Palestinians who are inside Gaza, how does that play out? Is that salvageable given the current climate?
There's so much to say about that, Kylie, but let me just sort of summarise a few points. There was a ceasefire so-called announced in October, and since then there has been no cessation of violence. There are still people, Palestinians, mostly civilians, being killed every day. There's been at least 1,200 since October. Israel now controls about 60-70% of Gaza. As anyone who has seen images or videos of Gaza, it remains a leveled, utterly destroyed area. There's no rebuilding. There is massive issues of infrastructure. There's rats eating children's feet while they sleep. I have friends and colleagues in Gaza. I've been to Gaza many times, but not since October 7, of course, as Israel continues to refuse international journalists. The situation there is desperate. Israel says, well, we're not going to leave anything, or not going to leave Gaza until Hamas disarms. Now, the question of Hamas disarmament is a live one and a real one, and it's a question that both Hamas and the Palestinians in Israel should discuss. But this idea somehow that Israel, which is what it wants, to stay there permanently, that is the desire. And it's worth saying that the likely successors to Netanyahu, assuming he loses, have no different views on this question. The desire, and I don't think it's really a secret, is to leave Gaza decimated, to leave it utterly destroyed. And the ultimate goal, like in the West Bank, is to push Palestinians out. Israel has been trying for years now to find willing countries in Africa and beyond to take these Palestinians. They have not succeeded, but they've been trying. So, of course, the idea of ending violence in Gaza and rebuilding is vital, but there is no real Israeli constituency for that position, and nor is there any US pressure to do so. Why would Israel change?
Anthony, just finally, the Anti-Semitism Royal Commission has been going on in Australia here for some weeks now. You're a Jewish Australian yourself, and there have been lots of strident statements made about all kinds of things, but including targeting the pro-Palestinian movement. What are your observations broadly of what we've seen and heard at the Commission?
After the horrific terrorist attack in December here in Sydney, I think it was wholly necessary to have some kind of formal investigation into how that happened and how these two alleged killers got away with murder. What's concerned me since the beginning of the Royal Commission is it's not really about the Bondi terror attack. I know it's talking about that indirectly. It's about anti-Semitism and social cohesion. And as a Jew, I don't deny for a second anti-Semitism is real. I think in many parts of the world, including here, it's growing. But what's concerned me is that so much of the evidence given, not all, there's undeniably been cases and horrific evidence given of real anti-Semitism, people being attacked for simply being Jews. And that's completely unacceptable. And that, as a Jew, that obviously concerns me, as it would be if it's a Muslim or some other minority faith. But so much of what we are hearing is not about anti-Semitism. It's about hurt feelings that Israel is being attacked or smeared or demonized. This is not anti-Semitism, in my view, and many people's view. It is a deliberate conflation between anti-Semitism and, say, anti-Zionism. Or, I mean, I remember one case of a woman giving testimony at the Royal Commission that she had to hear, I think it was critical ABC coverage on Gaza as she went up in her lift, you know, and I sort of thought, hang on a minute, that's not anti-Semitism. Why are we hearing this? You have the right to be hurt. You have the right to say you don't like to hear that commentary or reporting. But what has happened is many, many young Jews do not anymore accept the fact that as a Jew, we have a moral responsibility to support Israel uncritically. You can argue whether it's genocide or not. You can argue a range of things. That's a legitimate conversation. But to suggest somehow that this has all been defensive and somehow that testimony at the Royal Commission, which has often been people demonizing peaceful pro-Palestine protests, this idea somehow that those kinds of protests are wholly illegitimate, and that's being heard at a Royal Commission, what has that got to do with Bondi? I mean, it's pretty clear what the connection is being made here, certainly by those who push that Bondi was almost inevitable because there are people waving the Palestinian flag saying free Palestine. And they say it explicitly. I wholly reject that. And I fear that there will be a push to try to censor or curtail legitimate speech on this issue. Hate speech and calling for violence is wholly unacceptable, whether it's against Jews or others. No question about that. And if that happens, it needs to be charged, as there's already laws for that. But trying to curtail legitimate conversation about another country, Israel, needs to be allowed and endorsed. We have a right to do that in a democracy. So I am, shall we say, concerned about where the Royal Commission is headed, and I'm being polite about that.
Anthony Lowenstein, thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
And that was Anthony Lowenstein. He's an independent journalist, filmmaker, and author of the Walkley Award-winning book, The Palestine Laboratory, and host of the Anthony Lowenstein podcast. Kylie, so much to unpack there, but gosh, as a quick first comment, how depressing was all of that to listen to? Such a quagmire and so intractable.
I'm not sure it's intractable, but I agree with the quagmire part of it. I think some of Anthony's arguments that if there was the political will for the situation to change, then it is changeable. But at the moment, there's certainly no evidence of the kind of political will that might be required to change it. I was particularly interested in his very kind of fresh evidence of what the situation is in the West Bank and the direction of travel of what's going on in the West Bank. The fact that you now have a greater degree of impunity, you could argue, for the settlers, more organised support and funding for the settlers from the government, and that kind of nexus between the Netanyahu government and the settlers and their objectives, I think feels to me to be a pretty solid explanation of why things are now so dangerous for Palestinians in the West Bank. But also, I wonder what you think about this idea that it doesn't really matter who wins the election, whether or not Netanyahu stays in power. These are enduring policies of any Israeli government.
I'm less sure about that. I've spoken to a fair few diplomats who have told me that their Israeli counterparts are basically holding on in some of their posts until the election. And then after that, they will leave serving their country. There's huge waves of emigration out of Israel. I think a lot of people are simply holding on until the election. And I don't share Anthony's complete view that the concerns that are held are more a minority across society. I think they are there, they're real, they're deep. And we'll see a bit more of them come out, I think, after the election, pending what that outcome is.
I mean, we've spoken before to Dahlia Scheinlin, haven't we, the Israeli pollster, on what popular opinion is about the situation in the West Bank and in Gaza. And I wonder what her research would show about whether or not it's in fact impossible to win power in Israel unless you commit to remaining, you know, on a kind of defensive posture within Palestinian territories. How likely are you to win? If you say, okay, we'll pull out of Gaza, we'll stop harassing Palestinian communities on the West Bank. Although I've got to say, weirdly, my experience was when I was based in Gaza, it was around about the time when Ariel Sharon, who was a hawkish Israeli leader, he was the one who withdrew the settlements from Gaza. So sometimes 2 + 2 doesn't equal 4 in the politics of Israel, and unpredictable things can happen. And I guess I am hopeful that there is some unpredictability.
Yes, Kylie, hope is a necessary quality in today's world, I think. Keep your feedback coming. We love to hear from you. The email is, of course, global.roaming@abc.net.au. Thank you to our producer, Aston Brown, supervising producer, Pat Sunderland, and our executive producer, Laura McAuliffe. We'll be back with you again tomorrow. See you, Kylie.
Bye, Latika.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.